Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Check.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Imagine a really cool underground music venue that plays only your favorite music. It's really exclusive and people are dying to get in. But it's not crowded, because you have to die to get in.
With godlike comfort and angelic interior, the Catacoffin employs a pair of two-way speakers, tweeters, and a divine 8-inch subwoofer, fine-tuned to the coffin's unique interior acoustic space.
I am not making this up, and on Wednesday, I'll prove it. We'll talk to the Swedish company that is making these specially designed coffins, which will play your favorite music for you while you, you know, lie there all dead and stuff. Now, we want to know, what music do you love so much that you'd take it with you for your afterlife entertainment? We'll be taking your calls live on the air Wednesday night. And just to show you how serious we are about this, we'll have two studio guests, Eugene Merman and John Glazer. Okay, yeah, they're both comedians, but it's a serious question. What music would be on your eternal playlist? Join us Wednesday and call in, or leave us a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. Now, assuming you'll be living with us through the next hour, you'll hear Ethan Hawke playing some songs from his new off-Broadway play, Clive, and a new installment in our occasional series of improbable pop songs called That Was a Hit. Also, today is National Grammar Day. I'm not making that up either. Recently, our contributor Faith Saley took to our blog to express her frustration about bad grammar in music. She joins me here in the studio now. Welcome back, Faith.
Hi. Do I have chalk all over me? I sound like a school marm.
When did you start noticing bad grammar in songs?
Well, my most egregious offender was in the late 90s, and that's sort of when I started paying attention to bad grammar in songs.
So it was a single song that made your antenna go up and
yeah.
say, wow, if this person is using such a terrible grammatical egregious mistake, there must be others out there.
Right, because I also think when you're a kid and you just hear lyrics, you're not deconstructing them, one
right.
hopes, and you know, unless you're Doogie Howser or something. But but that's when I started, you know, when I'd sing them out loud, it just felt wrong, John.
All right, so give us the example that set you down this path.
Okay, well, this is clearly from your favorite TV show from the 90s, Dawson's Creek.
Oh, yes.
I know you cared about Joey and Pacey, John.
I know there was a guy named Dawson, and there was a creek.
Very good. This is the theme song. It's by Ms. Paula Cole. And, the opening lyric is, open up the morning light and say a little prayer for I. Oh.
Ouch.
So open up your morning light and say a little prayer for I. You know that if we are to stay alive and see the peace in every eye.
So that's a little of Paula Cole's I Don't Want to Wait. Now, the song was a radio hit. I mean, I recall
I know.
Hearing
I actually
this a lot.
I think it's a pretty tune. But when you hear, I mean, I'm not a lyricist, but those lyrics are horrible. I mean, first of all, it's an approximate rhyme, so it really sucks. Like, light doesn't really rhyme with I, so she could have searched further into, further, farther? I think it's farther into the thesaurus. And then the next line, also she uses I, I-E-Y-E. Anyway, it's I say a prayer for the objective case. It's horrible. And you know, I mean, people make that mistake a lot. Even our president makes mistakes with the objective case in speeches.
This might actually be a good time to bring in our other guest on the phone. Mignon Fogarty is the creator of the Grammar Girl podcast and website. Mignon, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you think of Paula Cole?
Well, it's amazing. I must have heard that song 1,000 times on the radio, and I never noticed that line. Something in my brain must have turned off when they used the wrong pronoun.
But that seems to be, as Faith is saying, that seems to be a very common mistake in music, outside of music. Can you give us what the correct version of the line, "Say a little prayer for I," would be?
It would be "say a little prayer for me," because me is the object pronoun that you use when, you know, when you're putting yourself in the object case. It's for me. You know, it's following a preposition.
Right. And there are certainly precedents. I mean, there is that song, "Say a little prayer for me."
Right. Yeah. Sometimes people get it right. I do notice a lot of pronoun errors in songs, though. The Olympic theme song a few years ago had a pronoun error. They said, "I believe together we'll fly. I believe in the power of you and I." And it should be "you and me." And it was the Olympic theme song.
Incorrect in any language in any country.
Did R. Kelly write that?
So we're talking about bad grammar in music lyrics. And Faith, you went out on the trolling the internet for examples,
yes,
Facebooking and tweeting and all that kind
of
stuff.
I was very gratified to see I'm not the only dorky person who cares about musical bad grammar. And there were lots of responses on my Facebook page. A lot of people talked about the objective case. I mean, there's that Bryan Adams song, "Run to You," mm-hmm. where he says, "Say our love will never die, but that would change if she ever finds out about you and I."
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Well, now, Harry came through our website, and he has another example that seems to go to what, Faith, what you and Mignon have been talking about. Hi, Harry.
Hi.
So give us your example of really bad grammar, possibly in a really good song.
It's The Doors in "I'm Gonna Love You Till the Stars Fall from the Sky for You and I."
So again, it's that it's not the objective form of the pronoun.
Exactly. And it would change the song if you put in "me," which would be correct, and it wouldn't be right. But it just kind of rankles because it's at the end of this swooping chorus, and it's, you know, it's just the final punch there, and it's just like, oh, fingernails on a chalkboard.
Now I'm gonna love you till the heavens stop.
All right, Mignon, Faith, I have to bring up the subject here of poetic license.
Yes.
I know that "you and I" is grammatically incorrect, but the previous line is "till the stars fall from the sky." "For you and me" just doesn't rhyme. It is the big, you know, rousing finale of the chorus.
Oh, I'll let the grammar girl have the final say. But in my blog post, John, I actually define what I think is musical bad grammar. Because, yeah, I mean, innovative language is the sine qua non of rap. You don't want to take away slang or colloquialisms.
Right.
I have no problem with "ain't no mountain high enough." My definition is when it would not change the lyric or the meaning of the song to insert the right word, or when it's just lyrically lazy. I mean, I'm not a songwriter, but I'm a writer. And when I write a sentence that doesn't sound right or bends the laws of grammar, I think, you know what? I got to go at that sentence again. I may have to scrap it.
Yeah. What do you think, Mignon?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, we want our artists to have the freedom to play with language and express themselves and reflect the communities they're trying to reach. And a lot of that is through slang and dialect. You know, with these pronoun errors, the pronoun errors are pretty common in songs. And in some way, I think that they might also be reflecting society because, you know, it's one of the top 10 things people ask me about is when they should use "I" or "me" in a sentence like this. It's a common point of confusion. So I often find myself wondering whether the artists actually know they're making an error.
Or if they're just high. I don't think people are punctilious when they're on heroin.
They're more likely to make up words, which would make their songs more interesting.
Is this where we start talking about the pompatus of love, the old Steve Miller song where he makes up this word?
That's interesting.
That is interesting. That's creative use of language. Let's go back to the phones. Marjorie is on the line with us from Suffern, New York, upstate. Marjorie, what you got for us in terms of bad grammar?
Well, yeah, I'd like to touch upon that issue of poetic license, and I think a great example of poor grammar But excellent poetic license is Bob Dylan's song Lay, Lady, Lay. Hmm. Lay across one big brass bed. Now, it should be lie across one big brass bed, or lay yourself down across one big brass bed. However, there's two things here. The long A sound, lay, lady, lay, sounds good.
Right.
And he's also singing in the voice of the man whose, quote, clothes are dirty but his hands are clean. So perhaps the man is a less educated blue-collar worker whose English isn't perfect. So perhaps this example of poor grammar is excusable.
Well,
yeah, and also there's suggestiveness to the word lay, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Although Robert, from not too far from you, Marjorie, Robert in Westchester County commented on our website about that exact song. He writes, I also cringe at Bob Dylan's Lay, Lady, Lay. I know the long A sound is a nice assonance, but it's such bad grammar. Maybe Lie, Lady, Lie wouldn't have been a hit.
Lay, lady, lay. Lay across my big brass bed. Lay, lady, lay. Lay across my big brass bed.
Well, it's all a question of tolerance. How much tolerance do you have for bad grammar in music lyrics when you even notice it? Faith Saley has been noticing it and talking about it on our website and on Facebook and Twitter. And grammar girl Mignon Fogarty is with us on the line as well, and we're taking some calls and comments. Soundcheck listeners, got an example of musical bad grammar that you'd like to share? You can leave a comment on our website at soundcheck.org. What about, Faith, subject-verb agreements? They versus his and her. And
right. And as Mignon will say, people commonly make that mistake when they're talking, and they do it when they're singing. There's a Nickelback song, If Everyone Cared, and if everyone shared and swallowed their pride. Now, of course, lyrically, it may not flow if they said swallowed his or her pride,
right.
But they could say his or her. And then Leonard Cohen has everybody knows the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. I don't know. I mean, I wish Leonard Cohen had nailed the grammar, but I don't hold him as responsible as Nickelback because Nickelback. and
well,
Nickelback,
that's
played in strip clubs, and I don't think people are there for the grammar.
Mignon?
You know, but it's not actually the using they as a singular goes way back and is often used in literature, so it's not just songs. Jane Austen would say everyone should wear their best dress to the party or something like that. So Jane Austen actually did it frequently, so it's a lot more common in English than people realize, and even in printed works. I mean, it's not considered standard English. Don't do it in a cover letter. Don't use they as a singular, but it's very common because English doesn't have a pronoun you can use when you don't know whether someone's a male or a female.
Well, there is. I mean, you could use one, swallow one's pride. But who's gonna do that? Henrietta is joining us on the line. And Henriette, I understand you have an example that sort of ties in with what we were just talking about.
Yeah, it's Sting. I don't even remember the title of the song, but it's If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free.
Well, that is the title of the song.
So, you know what? You're right. It is. That's another case where, as Faith is saying, he could and should have said, if you love somebody, set him or her free. But it kind of ruins the song. But then this is a man who has a precedent of using one specific gender pronoun. Every little thing she does is magic.
Right.
So why couldn't he have done, if you love somebody, set her free? And that would have been much better.
It would have been much better than the grammatically correct, if you love somebody, set him or her free.
Right. But even, if you love somebody, set them free. I know we do that all the time now. We use them as the singular pronoun, as we were just saying, but it just sounds so wrong in that particular refrain. It's very glaring.
And it sounds wrong like this. So Sting with If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free. We're speaking with Faith Saley and Mignon Fogarty about bad grammar in music lyrics. So what about, you know, when it seems to be intentional? I mean, so far we've been, a lot of the songs we've been talking about, it seems like people just got it wrong without realizing it. You know, I kind of suspect that however well the You and I works in the Doors song, that maybe Jim Morrison wasn't even thinking about whether it was grammatically correct
or
not.
Right, or he wouldn't care, right.
Right. So, but how much of a pass do we give for things that are just plain wrong when maybe it's a character
right.
who's getting it wrong?
If it is somebody's voice, it's like writing bad grammar within a novel. You know,
right.
Faulkner didn't have all his characters speak perfectly. What do you say, Mignon?
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I mean, in fiction, you wouldn't want to use proper grammar for your characters or they'd all sound stilted and unnatural. And I think a lot of times it's the same in songs. And the other thing about music is that, you know, musicians often want to portray themselves as outsiders or rebels. And, you know, using sort of, quote, bad language is one way to do that.
Right.
It's a very effective way to do that, actually. And then it's also a way to speak to your particular community by, you know, a rapper is going to use different bad grammar than a country western singer. And it's sort of saying, you know, this is how we talk. This is our little, you know, band of people, our little group. And we all fit in together because we speak a certain way. I mean, it's just like, you know, teenagers in the hall at school, they have their own way of speaking to each other. And that's what a lot of musicians are trying to do, is create that community, that sense of we're all together, but we're rebels.
So there's two things here. One is that, you know, you do what makes the song sound good. And when Jerome Kern wrote Old Man River, he did a lot of what you, Faith, and you, Mignon, have just been talking about, you know, writing it the way, you know, people in the South at a certain time, the way they spoke.
Capturing
right.
a feeling.
And in fact, the great old radio comic Stan Freberg did a hilarious bit where he's sitting in the studio with a censor, and the censor is hitting a buzzer every time Stan Freberg says or sings something grammatically incorrect because of the tiny tots listening at home. You know, you need to be precise and proper and get your etiquette right and your grammar correct. And it's, well, listen to what Old Man River sounds like if it were grammatically correct.
Elderly Man River, that Elderly Man River, he must know something, but he doesn't say anything. He just keeps rolling, rolling. He just keeps rolling along. He doesn't plant taters, potatoes. He doesn't plant cotton, cotting. And them, these, those that plants them are soon forgotting. But Elderly Man River, he just keeps rolling along.
Excellent.
I happen to know that Stan Freberg was very proud of the them, these, those, you know, as he's casting about to find the correct pronoun. Them, these, those that plants them are still forgotting. He was very proud of that line, which just goes to show that, you know, Jerome Kern kind of knew what he was doing.
Right,
bad grammar
right,
and all.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Mignon Fogarty is the creator of the podcast and website Grammar Girls, Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing. Faith Saley, contributor to CBS Sunday Morning, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and Soundcheck. And thanks to everyone who called and commented. You can leave your examples of bad musical grammar on our website at soundcheck.org. And, of course, we here at Soundcheck couldn't let National Grammar Day go by without a little festive singing. I leave you with the Soundcheck Chorale and their grammatically correct karaoke.
Lie, lady, lie. Lie across my big breast bed. New York. Concrete jungle out of which dreams are made. You can do everything. Now you're just somebody who I used to know. What if God were one of us?
Up next, actor Ethan Hawke joins me in the studio to talk about his rock star role in the off-Broadway production Clive. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In 1918, the great German writer and theater director Bertolt Brecht composed his first full-length play called Baal. The title character is a drunken, womanizing, brawling poet who destroys nearly everything and everyone around him. Now, Baal has inspired a new off-Broadway production called Clive. Ethan Hawke directs it and stars as its poisonous title character. Jonathan Mark Sherman wrote the play and is part of the cast as well. It's running through this Saturday at the Acorn Theater, and both Ethan and Jonathan join me here in the studio to talk about it. Guys, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We'll be hearing some music in a moment, and violinist Dana Lynn is also here with us in the studio. But Ethan, you've been doing a lot of theater work over the years. What was it about this particular story that attracted you?
It's hard for me to say. I guess I'll tell the story of it. Is I was playing a character in Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing Autolycus, and it was kind of set in the early 1900s, and I carried a guitar, and I played some of these kind of Woody Guthrie, Shakespeare songs a la via Woody Guthrie. And after a performance, or it might have even been a tech rehearsal, Tom Stoppard, who happened to be watching, came up to me and
said, playwright.
The playwright, yeah. Yes. Sir Tom came up to me and said, "Have you ever read Baal? I think you should play Baal as Autolycus." And I hadn't read it. And I texted Jonathan Mark Sherman, my friend here, you know, because I wanted to seem smart in front of Stoppard. I was like, "What is Baal?" Sherman's like, "Yeah, I think it's Brecht. I read it when I was stoned in college." And we both started talking about it, and we both read it, and it started this journey that turned into us being here with you.
So Jonathan, instead of, you know, Germany in 1918, you've set Baal as Clive as a rocker on the indie scene, the downtown scene here in New York in the 1990s.
Yes.
Did you guys live here? Were you on that scene in New York in the 90s?
We lived here. To say we were on that scene is a bit of a stretch, I think, or would be shot down by actual indie rockers who were on that scene. They would probably say something like, "I didn't see
Kurt
those
Cobain.
Guys.
That,
yeah, yeah, I didn't yeah, see those yeah. guys that much." But we certainly lived here.
We were wannabes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, now, what do you make of the character of Baal or Clive? I mean, it's the same character. Brecht, you know, he's certainly not a moral guy in Brecht's original play, but you wouldn't say he's immoral. He's kind of amoral. He has his own kind of code.
I would say that's right, yeah. He a thing I tried to keep in mind during the adaptation was this idea of trying to understand this kind of person rather than to judge this kind of person, which becomes progressively harder for most of us to do as the play goes on, but I think is really important to understand this kind of person, especially since these kind of people are amongst us. You know, they were amongst us in 1918. They're amongst us in the 90s. They're amongst us today. So
the play asks a really, I think, profound question, which is that somebody without a moral rudder is living in the same galaxy that we are,
mm-hmm.
and living under the same stars that, you know, that we are implies that all of us have some kind of wonderful moral rudder that we guide our lives by, but I'm not sure that's true. But let's just say...
Why are you looking at me when you say that?
No, I find it fascinating how much people love this idea of a clear narrative structure where something happens, and if a character does something bad, well, then something bad happens to them, and they learn a valuable lesson from mm-hmm. that, and then their life works better. And yet in our daily life, we don't see clear narratives all the time. We rarely see them. And that our lives are shaped by these decisions that we make, but we largely all fly on our own instinct. And whether or not that instinct carries us to a noble place or carries us to an ignoble place has a lot to do with our DNA.
Well, and, you know, in a funny way, a lot of that, the first wave of punk had that same kind of It almost sounds nihilist, but you could actually see it as the opposite of that.
It was funny, when we were in rehearsals, I ran into, out of total fluke, I ran into Patti Smith on the street, and she said, "Oh, you're doing Bow. That's my favorite play." I said, "Well, you're the first person who's ever said that to me." and it is, it's definitely that spirit.
Yeah.
It's that spirit of, hey, you know what, you guys, the world is a very dubious place.
Speaking with Ethan Hawke and Jonathan Mark Sherman, the actor, director, and writer, respectively, of Clive, the off-Broadway play in its final week at the Acorn Theater this week. Well, what about the role of music in the play Clive? I mean, you as Clive, you've got a guitar with you for much mm-hmm. of the play. There are songs involved. Is it a reflection of who a rock singer, songwriter in the early 90s of New York would be? Or is there something...
Not to me. Not specifically like that. It's an ageless story.
Yeah.
And we're trying... What's fun about adapting a 1918 play and setting it in the 90s, you start to see, like, I've almost imagined it as the 90s that Bertolt Brecht would imagine.
Mm.
He didn't imagine computers. All right. He did imagine that they'd have red powder instead of the white powder he had seen, you know, and he knew they'd still have a piano, you know.
He wouldn't know what to make of the Pixies or Pavement, but he would know what to make of maybe the blues.
Or to that end, I could imagine Bertolt Brecht imagining Wilco. You know, or the whole alt country scene.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that weird place where punk and country met.
Yeah. So the first songs you're going to do for us, you're going to do two short things that are in the play,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, why don't I do those, yeah.
And they are kind of anachronistic, if we're being really literal about this taking place in New York City in the early 90s in the rock clubs.
One of the ideas that we had was that one of the great Clives in history was Elvis Presley. And, you know, a person who totally destroyed themselves mm-hmm. and had, you know, and to kind of reach back, and the inspiration for Love Me Tender was this song, Oralee, which was a Civil War song that Elvis loved to sing, but had too much political meaning when he was coming up to sing it, so they changed the lyrics a little bit. And so we shape-shifted it back to its Civil War era.
Okay.
And then the other piece is just a little blues riff that I have to admit, I wish he was here. Vincent D'Onofrio does so well with me in the play mm-hmm. that it seems wrong to do it without him, but I think we'll give it a go.
Okay. Ethan Hawke and violinist Dana Lynn performing here in the studio. Ethan is the director of Clive and stars in the title role. Jonathan Mark Sherman, the playwright, is also here with us in the Soundcheck studio. Here are a couple of musical excerpts from Clive, once again in its final week at the Acorn Theater, running through Saturday, March 9th. And you can find more information on our website at soundcheck.org.
It feels like 4 days since I've been on this floor. With this bottle, or a very similar bottle. With this guitar, with this notebook, there have been defeats. But the bodies are falling back into the Egyptian darkness, into the walls now. I must not drink anymore. Oh, my hands tremble. The bodies aren't in the walls. They're in my hands. My heart beats like a horse's hoof. Oh, Joanna, I would have rotted among the fish if I spent another night in your aquarium. Oh, I'm a lover alone. I'm being defeated again. Oh, I'm being evicted. I need to find myself a woman. To move out by oneself is sad. Anyone with a woman's face. So that's a little like that. It really needs D'Onofrio.
Vincent D'Onofrio also in the cast of Clive. That's Ethan Hawke singing, playing guitar. Dana Lynn on violin. All right, so you want to do Oralee?
Yeah, yeah, here we go. Was the blackbird in the spring beneath willow tree. Said any bird will I heard him sing a song of Orly. Orly, Orly, made of golden hair. Sunshine came and went with thee, the swallows in your hair. Take my ring, take my everything. Holy, holy, made of golden hair. Sunshine came and went with thee, swallows in your hair. Zoe Kazan usually sings that one with me, and, mm-hmm. and she does that better than I do.
Ethan Hawke with us on Soundcheck. He directs and stars as Clive in the play of that name, which is running this week at the Acorn Theater. Jonathan Mark Sherman wrote the play, inspired by Bertolt Brecht's Ball. You also heard Dana Lynn playing violin. So Orly, the old Civil War ballad that Elvis Presley used to such good effect when he rewrote it as Love Me Tender, a little bit of blues as well. Jonathan, when you looked at Ball, the original Bertolt Brecht play, he wrote those songs for mm-hmm. Ball, the original songs that are there. So at what point did you guys, you know, come up against the idea of, well, what do we sing? What kind of music will this guy, this Clive, be playing?
From the very start, we knew that music was going to be an enormous part of this play. It's the shorthand we used from the first reading was myself and Ethan and Shelby Gaines, who's one of the two brothers, Shelby and Latham, who comprise Gaines, who designed these
the sound sculptures.
Seven incredible sound sculpture door instruments that we kept using the term sonic landscape. We were hunting for the sonic landscape of the play. And we hunted a lot of places for it. Living room, bar, art gallery, college campus.
Yeah, we did readings in all those locations that Jonathan mentioned. We would just read the play in different places, hunting for what the play is supposed to sound like. Mm. The songs in Brecht's original are unique and
yes, to
be friendly. and so we were looking for something that might fit our world and pay homage to them. And the Gaines brothers really kind of came up with this idea of, you know, really creating a set that could be played by the actors. And that's what Dana, who's here with us today, she's playing the violin with us here in studio, but on the stage she plays these doors.
Right.
And it's really, it's fascinating. And, you know, Brecht had this, I think it matches what, it's simpatico with Brecht's ethic of theater should have some magic to it. Mm. You know, that it just needs to be something a little like, oh, how'd that work?
Well, and Brecht also seemed to want to keep his audience kind of guessing, you know?
Very much so.
And, you know, to see these seven, there's seven of them,
yeah.
right? And they all have different sounds. I mean, for people who haven't seen it, the idea of playing a door, at least one of the doors seems to be hollow, where when you can kind of rap on it and
and it has a sheet of aluminum in it that when it vibrates to your voice, and so it echoes whatever's near it.
Right, and then there's another door that has a kind of, it's like an enormous thumb piano kind of thing and stuff.
It's actual ripped out of a piano. They did the keys. It's very strange, and one's kind of like a bass and one's kind of like a guitar.
Yeah.
And one has a giant singing bucket mounted on a chalkboard.
Right.
pastures where we shall live and die nevermore, even though.
And the guitar-like one, do you know what a diddly bow is?
Yeah, it's based on a diddly bow. Well, that's the idea of it.
The original blues instrument where you tack two nails into a door or a wall, add some baling wire, and there you have
Shelby
it.
Shelby and Latham love the diddly bow.
Okay, all right. So that kind of blues that you played echoed in that door.
This ended up being our sonic landscape, you know.
Speaking with Ethan Hawke and Jonathan Mark Sherman about their play Clive, inspired by Bertolt Brecht's Ball, and inspired by other singer-songwriters you were telling me before we went on.
One of the ones that I remember this story about Townes Van Zandt that it always fascinated me.
This is the Texas singer-songwriter.
Yeah, Texas singer-songwriter. And so I grew up listening to him. He was a big inspiration to a lot of the musicians. You know, the musicians that I loved, Kris Kristofferson, Willie Nelson, Johnny Kidd, the famous ones, would all say, oh, yeah, but, you know, Townes Van Zandt's the real deal. You know, and so I ended up, well, I watched this documentary about Townes Van Zandt, and there's this sequence in it where he talks about being at a party and he was sitting in a window seven flights up and he's obviously using something, right? But he finally gets it into his head that he really wonders what it would be like to fall from this window. And he thought the only way he would know, and he wanted to know it more than he wanted to know anything else that was going on, is to do it. And so he just, while talking to people, just dropped out of the window and fell seven floors and lived to tell this tale. But he didn't seem to prize his life at very much. And he had this kind of idea that I think is true of Clive and I think is true of Ball and is true of many serious artistic people that they sometimes get it into their head that to be true, to be the real deal, you must not participate in the commercial world. And that I've met some very, very serious, remarkable artists that just take themselves out of that equation.
Is that why you do so much theater? I mean, as opposed to the Hollywood things that you do? Does theater give you that kind of, that feeling of, I don't know, I hate to use the word like authenticity, which has become, but, you know, what you were just talking about, the feeling that you're not in something that's commercial necessarily.
For me, I have no anti-commercial feelings, but the commercial doesn't bother me one way or the other. I love doing Training Day, and I love doing weird, obscure, you know, movies or plays that nobody sees. If I'm working with talented people.
Right.
In general, the theater really values writing, and great writing is really fun to act. And in general, movies and television really want to sell a lot of tickets. And so in general, they're trying to put asses in seats. And so sometimes you end up having to say a lot of dumb lines like, the Russians will be here at 1:00, and if we don't get this plane out of the tarmac in 15 minutes, the whole world will blow up. And I try to spend as much of my life not saying those lines as I can.
You know. Said that so well that I'm wondering if we can put that into the play tonight.
So, but getting back to Townes Van Zandt, so he for you was one of those touchstones to think of when
for
when
me
you guys
he was
were
in a way I actually kind of based Autolycus. You know, I was telling you about the
Shakespeare kind.
I'd based that character of Autolycus on Townes Van Zandt, and so it's been a long meandering road, and because Clive is more dangerous, you know, and because Clive, I don't think I would, like you said, it's true. I don't, in a way, it's not narcissism, you know, in the clinical sense of that word. Is egocentric for sure, but it is amoral. He's careless. He's careless with his own life and the lives of others, and it eventually leaves him where the play leaves him.
Right.
Which is not a pretty place.
Right.
But it seems to be where he wants to be.
It's not accidental, I think, that Ball begins with him turning down a publishing deal or blowing a publishing deal, and Clive, really early on, you know, he's blowing a record deal.
Right.
You know, all the guys like Townes Van Zandt, Elvis, who, you know, all of these artists who punish themselves and punish people around them, talk about the more gigantic number of artists who never actually become Townes Van Zandt, become
right.
Elvis, who choose the substances and the sex and the throwing themselves into the world without care over the art.
And in both cases, in Bertolt Brecht's Ball and your own Clive, it's easy to look at that opening scene and say, oh, self-destructive. But then you find out it's not that at all. It's what you're saying. It's just a different way of looking at where your place in that ecology
is.
He's
not valuing the same things you
right.
value.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So Townes Van Zandt. Should I play one for you? Yeah, we'll
all
play
right.
a song
right.
for
I'd
us.
I'd love to. This is one that didn't make the production, but it lives as an inspiration for us. So this is an outtake from Clive.
Okay. It's an outtake from Clive. The new group's production of Clive is running off-Broadway at the Acorn Theater through this Saturday, March 9th. Information on our website at soundcheck.org. Ethan Hawke picking up the guitar. Once again, Dana Lynn with the violin. And here's Townes Van Zandt's song, No Place to Fall.
Well, if I had no place to fall and I need.
Due to rights issues, we are unable to podcast this performance from today's show, but the good news, you can stream the entire performance and interview at soundcheck.org.
To lay me down.
Ethan Hawke singing a song by Townes Van Zandt with Dana Lynn playing the violin. That's called No Place to Fall, and as Ethan told us, kind of an outtake from the play Clive. Didn't actually make the final production, but I guess still in your mind's ears as
yeah,
the play.
We for it on your show.
Okay. Ethan Hawke here with me, along with Jonathan Mark Sherman, who wrote this play, inspired by Bertolt Brecht's first play called Ball. I wanted to leave you guys with a recording of David Bowie's version
Great.
Of Ball.
Well,
now, did you guys know about this when you set down this path?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Bowie kind of, at that period in his life, exuded a Ballinian other id that he didn't have to do anything. You
right,
know, I mean,
right.
he just had to be there, and it just happened.
Yeah.
I have to have a lot of eye makeup and tricks.
And of course the hair, the kind
yeah,
of spiky
yeah.
blonde thing, which goes.
I have a picture of Bowie on my dressing room
really?
Mirror. Yeah, I find him a very inspirational figure.
Yeah. Are you guys as excited as I am that he's actually back in the saddle and releasing a new record?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
really exciting, yeah.
yeah. Well, I've seen him sing recently. He's amazing.
Yeah.
I saw him at some tribute concert thing where he just got up and sang one song. I was like, he's still got it, man.
Yeah.
Well, we're going back about 30 years for this recording of Ball's Hymn, one of the songs that Bertolt Brecht himself wrote for his play Ball, which now Jonathan Mark Sherman has rewritten into the play Clive, which is directed by Ethan Hawke, who stars as the titular character of Clive. And we've been speaking with them and hearing some music. And guys, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
Whilst his mother's womb contained the growing bough, even then the sky was waiting quiet and pale, naked, young, immensely marvellous, like Baal loved it when he came to us. That same sky remained with him in joy and care, even when Baal slept peaceful and unaware. At night a lilac sky, a drunken bough, turning pious as the sky grows pale.
Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern, we're taping a session with the New York-based singer, rapper, DJ, and producer, Tekla. You can be a fly on the wall and listen in at soundcheck.org. And if you're listening and want to pass us along a question or a comment, just tweet us, @soundcheck, on Twitter. Here's an example of some of the music of Tekla. Fake Tears is the name of the song. Called Fake Tears by the singer, DJ, and producer Tekla. Once again, she'll be joining us 2 p.m. tomorrow, live online at soundcheck.org. Hope you can join us too. Up next, it's another installment in our series.
That was a hit!
This is Soundcheck.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
That was a hit!
Everybody was kung fu!
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Joining us this week with another improbable hit song is Mara Eakin, music editor for the AV Club. Hi, Mara.
Hi, John.
So what'd you pick for us today?
I picked Ray Stevens' The Streak, classic 1974 hit.
The Streak. I remember this from when I was a kid. Oh, my God, this was everywhere.
It was. It was a... It was Stevens' second number one on the Billboard charts, and it spent 3 weeks at number one. And it was even really popular in the UK. And it actually sold 5 million copies, which is a lot of people buying singles of The Streak.
Of The Streak. For folks who aren't familiar with the song, this is what we're talking about.
And he ain't wearing no clothes. Well, yes, they call him The Streak. Fastest thing on 2 feet. Proud as he can be of his anatomy, he gonna give us a peek. Well, yes, they call him The Streak. Like to show off his physique. If there's an audience to be found, he'll be streaking it round, inviting public critique.
That's a little bit of The Streak by Ray Stevens, and yes, that was a hit. As Mara Eakin of the AV Club was telling us, 3 weeks at number one, 17 weeks on the charts in the spring of 74. Give us a little bit of context, Mara. What's this song about?
Well, the song capitalized on the streaking movement, which was popular at the time. Someone streaked the Oscars that year. A little later that year, it was the first sports event streaking, but in March at the University of Georgia, 1,500 students streaked.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about that.
Streaking being running without your...
Running nude.
Running naked through a ball field or school campus or what have you.
Yeah.
So somebody...
And all hang out.
So somebody actually made it onto the stage of the Oscars broadcast that spring?
Yes, Robert Opel or Opel.
Really, you actually know his name?
And it was voted the number one most memorable Oscars moment.
And I'm sure it did not hurt sales of Mr. Stevens' song. So, looking back at this, Mara, I mean, do you think really that was a hit, or does it kind of make sense given what was going on back then?
I think it makes sense a little bit that it was a hit. I think that now it would be one of those meme-type hits, those internet video-type hits. But at the time, it sold 5 million copies, which that's an insane amount of copies of a song, a silly song. It's actually 7 minutes long before the radio edit, about just running nude and a guy singing in a funny voice.
Right. And, of course, there were news breaks as well. Let's hear one of those from Ray Stevens' song, The Streak.
Hello, everyone. This is your Action News reporter with all the news that is news across the nation. On the scene at the supermarket, there seems to have been some disturbance here. Pardon me, sir. Did you see what happened?
Yeah, I did. I was just standing over by the tomatoes, and here he come, running through the pole beans, through the fruits and veggies, naked as a jaybird. Ethel's over in the jams, jellies, preserves, and pickles. I hollered over her. I said, "Don't look, Ethel!" She dropped a whole jar of kumquats and fell back into the sweet midget cider. Had us too late, she'd done been incensed.
So perhaps the only number one Billboard hit to continuously break away for alleged news coverage. That is from The Streak by Ray Stevens, 1974 song. That was a hit. Mara Eakin, music editor for the AV Club, joining us on the line. What do we know about Ray Stevens?
Well, Ray Stevens started making songs in the late 50s, and he's still making music to this day. But weirdly, he's made basically an equal number of funny songs, like Ahab the Arab and Harry the Hairy Ape, like novelty singles,
right,
and serious songs. Like one of his other biggest songs was a gospel song. And now he makes kind of right-wing songs that are anti-Obama. So, and then he puts them on YouTube.
Okay.
So, but he's pretty famous, and he sold a lot of records.
Yeah, and so a lot of novelty. I mean, Ahab the Arab, that was a big hit, what, maybe in the 60s or something?
Yeah, it was like in the early 60s, yeah.
Yeah. Not necessarily the most politically correct stuff, but, you know.
No.
So these were novelty songs. But The Streak had the advantage of also being kind of newsworthy. And it was, I guess at the end of the day, I mean, it was kind of funny, wasn't it?
It's definitely funny. I mean, especially now, if you watch the video, I remember getting into the song. I was born after 74, or at least I had a consciousness after 74. But I know this song because it would be on those TV commercials about like wacky compilation CDs that you could buy with funny songs on them. In the video, they always showed the video for this, and I was always like, oh, that song is pretty funny.
I never knew there was a video to it. Was it made
later?
I'm sure it was made later. Okay. Yeah, that figures.
It's on YouTube.
So our narrator is in these various places where the news reporter tells us that the streaking is going on. First of all, Ray Stevens, which voice or voices are his?
He's like all the voices.
He's all of them. Okay.
Yeah, he's all the voices.
and so, at every turn, he's trying to protect his wife, Ethel, from seeing the streaker as he goes running by.
Yeah, don't look, Ethel.
And then there's a big twist at the end of the song, right?
The big twist is that Ethel streaks herself and joins in at the basketball game.
Oh, yes, they call him the streak.
Whoa, here he comes again.
Fastest thing on
who's that with? Ethel, is that you, Ethel? Where do you think you're going?
Well, as improbable as it seems, that was a hit. Mara Eakin joining us for our occasional series. She's music editor for the AV Club. Mara, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
Say it as if there's an audience.
Don't forget, this Wednesday, we're going to be doing a live broadcast at our regular time, 9 p.m. Eastern, in which you'll hear from the creator of the Catacombo, the coffin sound system that we mentioned earlier in the show. We'll talk with comedians Eugene Merman and John Glazer about it, and you can be part of the conversation as well. We'll be taking your calls. All the details are on our website, soundcheck.org. That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow on the show, music industry legend Clive Davis recently released a tell-all autobiography called The Soundtrack of My Life. We'll talk with the Rock and Roll Hall of Famer about how he got into the music business and the many big-time careers he's shaped. Plus, musician and performance artist Holcomb Waller joins us to show off a new electronic-influenced sound. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC and New York Public Radio. Our production team includes
Katie Bishop,
Mike Katziff,
Greta Cohn,
Paul Schneider,
Irene Trudell,
Phil O'Neill,
George Wellington.
I'm Jason Isaac, and I can say my own name.
Thanks to our intern, Alex Kappelman, and our Gig Alert producer, Alex Abnos. Our executive producer is
Joel Meyer.
I'm John Schaefer. You're welcome. See you back here tomorrow at 9. This is Soundcheck.